Music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer, because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
The democratic forces in this country, the workers, the laborers, the small farmers, the minorities, the women who fought for their rights, that is the essence of democracy. And to the extent that life today is at all bearable for us and humane for us, to the extent that we are not ground to pieces, it's because of those democratic forces, because they can't go just so far. To the extent that we can argue today, the fact that I can sit up here and speak to you is not because this system of democratic capitalism, so-called democratic, gave me that right. They never gave us anything. We had to extract those rights from them.
That's Michael Parenti, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Michael Parenti on democracy. Discussions about democracy probably start in Athens about 2,500 years ago. A truism is society is democratic to the extent that its citizens play a meaningful role in managing public affairs. Democracy is located within the capitalist economic system, infamous for producing colossal inequality. There's no level playing field as great income and wealth translate into political power for the haves at the expense of the have-nots. We have procedural democracy, elections, broadcast debates, primaries, etc. Citizens are largely marginalized, overwhelmed by big money and powerful lobbies. Look at the widespread demand to ban assault weapons of war, or for universal single-payer health care, or protecting the environment, or affordable housing. People want those things, but elites have a simple message. Vote, then go home, and leave everything to us. Actual democracy is hollowed out. A Davos-type class rules. Our guest today is Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti was a leading independent political analyst, scholar, and author. Cornel West called him a towering prophetic voice. He taught at major colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy for the Few, Power and the Powerless, and Against Empire. He passed away on January 24th at the age of 92. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at the University of Colorado at Boulder in 1984. And now, Michael Parenti on capitalism.
I want to talk about capitalism. I think maybe it's time we do. It's a remarkable thing that you can take courses in political science and study institutions and policies and all, and never once is it mentioned that we live in a capitalist system. Now, I maintain that it's time we talk about that subject, because capitalism is a system which spins off enormous imperatives which prefigure much of political life and limit it. Ours is a capitalist system. What that means is that the land, the labor, the resources, the capital, the technology, all these things are used for the purpose of accumulating capital. The goal of capitalism is not to create jobs. In fact, capitalists will eliminate jobs if they can. It cuts labor costs. Nor is the purpose of capitalism to build communities. Capitalism will build or destroy communities as investment opportunities dictate. Nor is its purpose to create a better life and a better environment for the generations yet to come. Capitalism, corporations will use the environment as a septic tank if it serves their profit purposes, and they won't even help the generation that's struggling with it right now, let alone the ones to come. Nor is the purpose of capitalism to create efficiency and avoid waste, because capitalism constantly pours its inefficiencies and diseconomies onto the public and into the public realm in the form of unemployment, injuries, unsafe products, pollution, things of that sort. No, ladies and gentlemen, capitalism has only one goal, and that's to make money for the capitalists. Karl Marx was right in Volume 1 of Capital. That's what it's about. Are we applauding? I hope you're applauding my criticism and not that goal. Nor is it because the capitalist is evil or venal. Individual capitalists are nice guys, some of them. It is the first law of capitalism, which is that you must make a profit or you go out of business. That's what it's about. It would be true for you, too, even if you went in with all the heartfelt desires to help the public, help your workers do this and do that, and so forth. If you did those things, you go out of business. If you decide not to foreclose on your tenants or on the notes you hold, then you'll lose them. And if they go to a good bank that feels like you and they won't foreclose and throw the people out, then that good bank, there ain't no such bank, but that bank will fail. And then the notes will be picked up by another bank, which will know what to do and will understand that the name of the game is capitalism. The function is to accumulate capital. That is the essence, the raison d'etre, the driving force in this society. Capitalism has no loyalty to nation or to flag or to democracy, or for that matter, to autocracy, or to God, or to atheism, or to any of those isms, or any of those things. It has no loyalty to family. There's no social force in human history to compare to capitalism when it comes to the destruction of traditional values, the Gemeinschaft values of homegrown rural and city life, the extended family, the clan, and now even the nuclear family. It pounds away at things, as Marx says, and it recreates everything in its own image. It has no loyalty to anything but itself. It is a remarkably rational system. That's what it's there for. It has no sentiment in it. It is imperative. All things, all people, all commodities, all values are reduced to instrumental objects to serve this end purpose, which is to make money in order to invest it, to make more money, to invest it, to make more money, to invest it, to make more money. As Marx said, it's money. With money, the capitalist produces commodities and services, which then give him more money. The function is to accumulate capital. Accumulate, 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 as Marx said, driving on endlessly. It is not to make automobiles, it's not to make clothing, it's to make money. And if the capitalist can make bad clothing and cheap clothing, that'll make him more money, he'll do it that way. But don't take my word for it. Let's take David Roderick's word for it. He's head of U.S. Steel Corporation. And he said, U.S. Steel is not in the business of making steel. He said it. It's in the business of making profits, unquote. Take the word of Henry Ford II, whose dedication to capitalism is above suspicion. Several years ago, when he was before the Ribicoff Committee on Automobile Safety, more than seven, more like 15 years ago, and why are automobiles so unsafe, Ribicoff was saying, and what's going on, isn't that? Ford finally turned around and he said, look, Senator, Ford Motor Companies isn't in the safety business. And he went better than Roderick. He made it more accurate. Because capital, the function of capital is not to make profits. He said it correctly. He said, Ford Motor Company is in the business of making the highest possible profits for its stockholders. That's the crucial point, remember. It's all relative. If you got your capital in here and you're only getting an 8% return, you yank it out and you put it there, even if you leave a community destitute where you can get 15%. So you must make as much as you can. Now, what dictates the allocation of these resources? What dictates how the land, the labor, and the capital, and the technology of our society will be used is this imperative and not social need or human need. If I'm a shoe manufacturer and you're all barefoot, that datum is of extreme indifference to me. I couldn't care less. You may need shoes, but I don't give you shoes because I'm not in the business of giving them to you. Your need does not dictate production and investment. It is your buying power. And that we call buying power plus want equals market. Now, if you need shoes or may just want them, you may have 20 pairs home already, then I become interested. And nor can I do it any other way because I'm not in the business of philanthropy. I'm not in the business of feeding the poor. When the Citizens Committee on Hunger and Malnutrition in America went to U.S. Food Corporation and said, what are you doing about the fact that 12 million Americans in this country do not have enough to eat? U.S. Food said, if we saw the opportunity for a profitable return on investment, we'd move into that area. And the Citizens Committee was indignant. But the Citizens Committee was wrong, and U.S. Food was right. One of those two groups understood what the system was about, and it wasn't the U.S. and it wasn't the Citizens Committee. It was the capitalists. There are only two groups in this country who understand what that system is about, and it's the capitalists and the Marxists. They both understand what it's about. And I agree with everything the capitalists say about how they operate. Not then all the tinsels and all the justification and ideologies they put on it, on top of it. So things which have no profit but are a great social value can become totally neglected or even abused by the system. Things like the environment, human life, human health. Things which have little social value but great profit will attract great investment. Like chintzy cars with a lot of chrome on them and such. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've uncovered a mystery. We've uncovered the mystery that has plagued liberals so long, which is, and conservative critics of government too, who profess to know the answer to that, which is why are we unable to solve our social problems of unemployment, environmental devastation, the decay of the cities, inadequate health care? The mystery is solved. We cannot solve these problems because that isn't what our land, labor, and resources are dedicated to. They're dedicated to something else. The end of the mystery. That changes our perception of it. Our social problems, therefore, if my analysis is correct so far, if I brought you along this far, manipulating you, you know, like the way we Reds do, right? If I brought you along so far, Then the very definition of social problem changes. Heretofore, we've thought of these problems as irrational spin-offs from a basically rational system, as aberrations. What I would argue now is that these problems are the rational outcomes of a basically irrational system. Pollution is rational. It's correct. It makes sense. It's correct for Goodyear Tire Company to go into Connecticut and build on the Mill River a factory and then dump its raw chemical industrial effusion into the Mill River, which took nature 100 billion years to create, which is used for recreation, for drinking water, for fishing, and all these, and destroy it and turn it into an open sewer. It's rational to do that because they cut their production costs and they increase their profits, which is their essence, the capital accumulation process. That's rational. It's correct. It's not correct from a human point of view. It's not correct from social values. But as I pointed out, capitalism has nothing to do with those social values. And when pressed on that, they will tell you. When you say you've polluted the environment, are you going to clean it up? And said, it's too big a problem for us. They're big enough to dirty it. They're not big enough to clean it up. And that's correct, too, because when they dirty it, they increase their margins of profits. When they clean it up, they would go broke. And they're not in the business of philanthropy, of doing anything that doesn't bring a profit. And we learn, too, that military waste is rational and correct. There is no such thing as waste under capitalism if it's bringing in a profit. It's wasteful to see two workers standing idly for 10 minutes. It's wasteful to produce a product which doesn't sell as highly as you want. But it's not wasteful to have two contracts of $1 billion each to build almost identical fighter planes, one from the Navy, one from the Air Force. That's not wasteful. That's wonderful. That's twice as much business. That's twice as much profit. And when liberals like Senator Proxmire get up and says, our military budget is riddled with duplication and waste, Let us remind ourselves that that is correct for capitalism. It's wasteful for the taxpayers. It's wasteful for the loss in human services and the other things for us. But it's not wasteful for those guys at the end of the trough who are holding the contracts. When you look at military spending and you see, first, it doesn't compete with the civilian market, the consumer market. When you produce refrigerators and you make profits, you produce more refrigerators, make profits, you produce more and more, you begin to cut your margin on profit per commodity. Now what you do is you're taking your profits and you're putting them into another whole area of demand and investment, which does not compete with your civilian markets. Second, it's an area which has a built-in obsolescence. So that means you no sooner spend $10 billion on one weapon system when you find out that it's kind of obsolete and you need a whole new weapon system. So it's constantly generating new demand and false demand. Third, it has guaranteed cost overruns of anywhere from 200 to 300 to 900%. And now we see with some of our hammers and screwdrivers, 20,000% of cost overruns. Those aren't cost overruns. Those are fixed prices. But cost overruns like the C-5A transport plane, which was contracted for $1 billion, and the company then turns around and says, sorry, it cost us $3 billion. And the Pentagon says, oh, $3 billion? $3 billion. What do you want? $7 billion? You know, whatever you want. It's not their money. Fourth, it's a contracted market, military spending. Unlike the automobile manufacturer who has to worry about selling those automobiles, these things have already been contracted. You've already guaranteed you're going to be paid for your production. You already have a market. Fifth, there's no competitive bidding, at least not in 95% of the contracts. That's an extraordinary thing. It means that any price you give the Pentagon, they take. Oh, is that how much? Okay, sure. We just said that. Finally, it's a form of public spending that does not expand the non-profit public sector. It does not expand those human services areas and those kinds of things. It doesn't bring in socialistic patterns of answering to human needs. It's like any other private contract that a company might get. They want tanks, it's like someone wants cars or something. In fact, Chrysler switches from cars to tanks and now back to cars. And it provides, given all that, the highest possible profits. So you see, the next time you talk about how bloated the military budget is, remember, it's quite rational. It's a rational outcome for a fundamentally irrational, insane system. That system is dedicated to the accumulation of wealth. But where does wealth come from? What is wealth? Well, wealth has two sources. One, the natural resources of our environment, the timber, the ore, the sun, the earth, all the things that can produce certain things. And second, the labor that goes into making those things. The thing that transforms a tree, which is a non-marketable item, although it's a very valuable item, into a commodity which brings profits to the capitalist, is the labor that goes into it, into that process. The labor that goes into harvesting the timber, the labor that goes into floating it down the river, transforming it into lumber, the labor that goes into making it into a chair or a piece of furniture, the labor that goes into the machines that are used to do all this, the labor that goes into getting it up on the truck and into the furniture store and writing the advertising copy and the salesman standing there and the labor that went into making that truck and all that sort of thing. It's labor. Labor that creates wealth. Capital does not create wealth. Capital does not produce anything. There was an ad I saw in the paper not long ago which said, what will capital be doing on Labor Day when all the workers will be out there at the barbecue pits? Capital will be working. It will still be building factories and homes and hospitals. We will put our capital to use here at, I forget what firm it was talking about that. That's not true, ladies and gentlemen. You could be rich as Rockefeller. You'd have all the money in the world and you could not build this building. You could not build this lectern. Only labor could do that. You could have all the capital in the world because capital is nothing but dead labor. If you work all summer and you finish that summer and you've saved $2,000 from your work, that $2,000 represents your labor of what you did before. Now, any capital that you have which you do not use for immediate consumption has to be mixed back with labor in order to have any kind of survival or vitality. Capital is nothing but pieces of paper, numbers and accounts. That's all the Rockefellers have. Stocks, you see, and things aside from their own direct capital holdings of, you know, their personal capital, like estates and houses and jewelry, which those things, too, are worthless unless there's someone who has the money to buy them. When you make that money, you've got to put it back. You've got to take that dead capital and mix it again with living capital, you see. Not me. I'll put my money in a bank and then just live off it if I want. But what do you think a bank is? The only reason the bank gives you 7 or 8% is because the bank itself is an investment house. It will then invest it and lend it out to someone else at 13 or 14%. And the only reason that someone else will take it at 14% is that he will then use it to employ people and make 19 or 20% or 50% or whatever else he might make. So that's what the system is about. It's labor which creates wealth. And the way to become wealthy is to pay workers less than the wealth that they create. That's the secret to getting rich. It's not to work hard, but to get others to work hard for you. Corporations today are called producer interests. They don't produce anything. They are organizational devices for the mobilization and accumulation of capital. But what the capitalist does is not only expropriate the workers' labor power, he also expropriates the worker's name. It's the worker, it's the ordinary working people who are the producers. And the more you pay those people, the less there's going to be for you. That's the problem for the capitalist. We'll get into that in a minute. The plot thickens. Don't managers produce? There was an encyclical put out by the Pope in which he said management too does very important work and makes decisions and plans. Yes, indeed. Management is not the owners. Managers work and they should be paid. They shouldn't be paid $3 million a year, but they should be paid something because they do make important and vital decisions of planning and business decisions if you want to run a company that way. They do work. Most top managers, however, have so much capital in savings that for all intents and purposes, they are part of the capitalist class themselves. But any middle manager works. He can get laid off tomorrow and thrown out on the street just like a steel worker. And many are so happening. Profits are the thing you make when you don't work. Income tax form used to have unearned income. Does it still have that? I don't remember. Earned income and unearned, that's marvelous, that little element of truth, very uncharacteristic of our government. Unearned income, that's the return you get on your interests and your investments. As you put your money to work, your money doesn't work, you put your money to command labor to bring you more money. What about your profits, Parenti? Don't you make royalties on your book? Yeah, but I wrote the book. Stunk, what do you think I did? I sat there for 2 years sweating and researching that book. And take another year on every new edition of it. That's my labor that goes into that book. And the people who do the copy editing, and the editor, and the printers, and the advertising, and all those people put their labor into that book, and that's where they get their salaries. The profits on that book go to the former Prime Minister of England named Harold Macmillan. The Macmillan family owns St. Martin's Press. I saw him on the Dick Cavett show one night, and Dick Cavett said, "How do you sustain yourself? What are you doing now?" And he says, "Our family has a little publishing house that does quite well." And I looked at him and I said, "No." "He makes more money on my book than I do. And he doesn't even know my name. And he doesn't even know half the titles that the publishing house puts out. He doesn't know any of them, probably. But what he does know is the bottom line. That is the parasite. That is the extortion. That's the highwayman. That's the toll keeper. That's the guy who takes it from you as you pass through. You cannot, you're extorted all the time. You cannot put a piece of bread into a toaster without making money for the Rockefellers or the DuPonts or the Mellons or the Morgans. Remember that. You cannot flick on a switch for light. That utility company is taking a shave of that which has nothing to do with the production of electricity or social needs and giving that to the people who sit around big tables in Chicago and New York who then use that money for all sorts of other purposes, namely the mobilization of political power. Now, there's a contradiction, of course, in trying to maximize your profits, and that has to do with wages and employing people. And when I say workers, I don't mean only in steel plants. God, it's a steam bath in here. Is everybody as warm as I am? Or am I just getting worked up? I don't know. That's as far as it goes. There's a contradiction that comes in. As I say, when I say workers, I mean just about everybody. I mean, even if you work after getting a college degree in a high-tech firm and doing other things, you're still a worker. You can be fired. I remember a Black Panther years ago who said it. He said, either you own the mother or you work for it. He used a longer word than mother, but he said, either you own the mother or you work for it. And that's what it is. Now, wages, because they cut into profits, must be kept down. That is the historic struggle between capital and labor. Wages, because they are the source of buying power and they create markets, must be kept up. That becomes one of the contradictions. And Marx put it very simply. He said, recessions occur when the workers produce more goods and services than they're able to buy back. There's this chronic tendency, a tendency toward a falling rate of profit, a tendency toward instability in the profit area, a need to cut back on labor, a need to mechanize, to save there, but then to find yourself with higher fixed costs and therefore needing more productivity to overcome the fixed costs. I've just given you now, and we're going to leave it, I've just given you all of Volume 1 of Capital. Not all of it, but enough maybe for tonight. Now, what is the role of the state? The state has several functions, as you know. The first function may be to carry out common functions that can't be carried out any other way. Another function is to provide for the common defense. And by the way, Marx and Engels recognized both those functions in the German ideology. They mention it just in the paragraph and pass over it. But the third function is to maintain the existing class structure, to maintain the interests of those who control the property and the wealth of society. And that means servicing wealth. For instance, in the late 1800s, the U.S. government gave away one half of all the land in the United States, literally hundreds of thousands of acres, in leases on coal, oil, etc., for a small percentage of their worth, and what was one of the greatest giveaways, it boggles the mind, to the capitalist interests of this society. It increases services, subsidies, regulations. It helps create demand by having big military budgets, all these things. And it also acts as a protector of wealth against those who don't have any wealth. That is the ultimate function of the state, as Engels said, beginning historically with those small bands of armed men who protect those who have wealth against those who don't. Don't take my word for it again. Let's hear what Adam Smith says. Again, impeccable credentials. Who, in his Wealth of the Nations in 1776, quote, civil authority is in reality instituted for the security of property, for the defense of the rich against the poor, or of those who have some property against those who have none at all. So said Thomas Hobbes also. So said Plato and Aristotle, for that matter. So said John Locke. So said John Harrington and James Otis and James Madison. They all said it and they approved of it. They saw it as a social necessity. When Marx came along and said it, but critically, and said this is unjust and wrong, then everybody dropped the subject. And today, one would not say that thing, that civil authority is instituted to defend the rich against the rest of us. Now, that class oppression of using labor as harshly, as fast as you can, extracting as much wealth from it as you can, forcing it to work 10 hours if you can, as in 1820, and having them work 12 and 13 hours by 1830, and having them work 15, 18 hours by 1840, and then bringing in little kids to work because they can't fight back and they're more malleable, and bringing in women to work because they could be bullied and intimidated, and doing this on and on, that class oppression does activate and evoke a reaction. That is, people fight back. So what you have is not only class oppression, but class struggle, a constant struggle. That class struggle is going on today still. The fact you don't have large masses of workers walking through the streets carrying red banners and singing the Internationale doesn't mean you don't have class struggle. Strikes, there still are plenty of them, more than ever. Demonstrations, sabotage, absenteeism, speed-ups, slowdowns, even fights over how much time a worker can take going to the laboratory, or what a boss may presume of his or her secretary. Every day, these kind of struggles, a constant grinding away of capital against labor and a constant fight back of labor and resistance of labor against capital. That struggle is carried on into the public arena, into the state.